Well, good morning. It's good to see all of you here this morning. I will put a qualifier on this sermon that it was not intended to be preached in this quarter. It was intended to be preached last quarter, but due to scheduling needs, it has been booted down the road like a football. But here we are. So this is not a pointed anything. It has nothing to do with the fact that we are studying the covenant in this quarter. It's simply something God has put on my heart, and I'd like to share it with you. You might notice a strange sounding word in the title of the sermon, and you may be wondering how it's pronounced. It's a Greek word. It's pronounced diatheke, as in he hath an AK-47 or something like that. I know I'm weird, but I have to have associations to remember hard words. Diatheke has nothing to do with AK-47. In fact, it's a really wonderful word. It's interesting, before we get into this word and the question, what's in it, have you ever had anything happen to you that caused you a sort of PTSD situation, where every time you ran up against something, you found yourself reverting back to a previous experience or understanding? Anybody? Not just, okay, I have. You see, if we get off on the wrong foot with something, it can, especially for younger, or if it's associated with some kind of trauma, it can color the way we view things later on in life. Is that not true? It is. If you get off on the wrong foot, if you misunderstand something, and we're going to talk about, there's a word called misapprehension. It's not a word much in use, but we're going to talk about it in a minute. But it can happen. And for instance, and it's a silly illustration, but I like silly illustrations. I'm a pilot, and I put a new avionics system in my airplane, and it has a glass panel, and those glass panels don't have round gauges anymore. They've got what they're called tapes. So you've got an airspeed tape on this side and an altitude tape on the other side. Now, I'm finding it rather challenging to figure out which is which. They look awful lot alike. So, you know, if you get those two messed up, it's not going to be a good, happy ending, is it? It could seriously impact the flight. pardon my pun. But yeah, you can really have trouble if you think you know what you're looking at. For instance, the airspeed and they almost look identical except for the numbers, and there's tiny little writing under the side and say IAS and ALT. That's all you got, right? That and your view out the window. It can seriously impact you if you misapprehend which is which, can't you? Yeah, and to take a look at this word misapprehension, an example is it's when you think you know about something, but you really don't. Anybody ever thought, I had that happen once. I didn't put it in the book. Brigetta said it wouldn't work for me. I'm going to use the story now. I remember when I was a kid, I heard about this thing called necking. Yeah, necking. So I turned somebody in. I was a rat fink. I saw someone necking Mom. I wasn't very old. I think I was in grade 1 or 2. I barely remember it. And she looks at me and says, do you know what necking is, Troy? Oh, yeah, I know what necking is. She said, well, why don't you show me what necking is? Oh, Mom, I'm not going to show you what necking is. No, you go ahead. My mom was a very wise woman. Pretty sure she knew I had a misapprehension about something. So it's kind of embarrassing. But I kind of went up, you know, at least I didn't wear a woman's blouse there, Terry. We'll have to talk later. No more umbrella cracks. So I went up to my mom, and I went up to her, and I put my neck on her neck. Which, of course, is not what necking is. But yeah, I had a misapprehension. I heard the words. I thought I knew what they meant, and I proceeded on to turn these poor people in on a flawed basis. Yeah, and it doesn't, you know, it's cute in those kind of things, but it can have really serious ramifications in our spiritual life. It can lead us to all sorts of conclusions that will poison our understanding when it comes to salvation. And I think you would agree with me, that's a bad thing. It's a really bad thing. It doesn't have to be on the surface level either. It can be subconsciously done. You think you know something, And as you're going through your prayer life or the things you say or as you talk to others or when you're reading the scriptures, this misapprehended piece of information can kick in, even though you may not even be aware of it, and color the conclusions that you come to. And we have just such a word. I mean, you know, it can lead us to be like Pepe Le Pew. I know he's been banned now by the haters. But you remember Pepe Le Pew, the skunk who could not figure out why she resisted his advances? You know, is involved with a can of white paint somehow or another getting on a black cat. You know, and he couldn't figure it out. You know, or what I like to call the blind man's cat. You see these possums running around. I've heard it called the blind man's cat once, as a face only a mother could love. But you see what I mean? You go up to pet one of those babies and you might come away with rabies. I don't know, but it can color everything we do if we're not careful. And I think that the best way to dispel darkness, even if you're not aware of it, because many of us aren't aware of it, is to do what? What's the best way to dispel darkness? Yeah, admit some light. Admit some light. And so that's what I'm going to try to do here this morning about this word diatheke. And it's very important. You know, and I don't want to overstate it, but I think that the correct understanding of this word and what it means and the implications that it has for you and me on a personal level can revolutionize our relationship with Jesus. It can revolutionize the position that we hold when we try to deal with him. It's a position that's very important. Our spiritual natures since the fall have been corrupted. We always want to try and play God. We always want to be God. Now, we may not say it overtly, but you hear it all the time. We live in a society now that it's rampant. We will decide what is morally correct and we'll cancel you out if you don't agree with us. We will decide what is good and what is bad. It's on us. And the Israelites had the same kind of problem when it came to a corruption of their faith. And this corruption led to the same kind of result. You remember the Israelites had gone down to Egypt. They'd been there 400 plus years, right? And what was in Egypt? Well, the Egyptians were in Egypt, people. I thought that was an easy one. But what else was in Egypt? What came part and parcel with the Egyptians?
Idolatry,
their religion. And what was the religion of Israel? It was a monotheistic religion. It was a religion based on the covenant given by Abraham, or to Abraham by God, a covenant based on the sacrifice of God for the salvation of man. But the Egyptian religion was based on something entirely different. It was based on a pluralistic relationship with the gods. When I say pluralistic, I mean there was a give and take going on. And it's the same way with all pagan religions, even those that bear the name of Christian, because there are such things. And there are such attitudes, even in perhaps my life and your life. I know there have been in my life. I pray God that he will disabuse me of them entirely. But this give and take relationship where the gods will bless you if what? If you please them, if you do something for them. Maybe you need to, you know, the Nile didn't flood. We must have done something to displease the gods. What shall we do? Oh, I don't know. Let's go up to, you know, Memphis or Thebes or somewhere, and we'll offer a bunch of sacrifices and, you know, show them how sorry we are. And the Greeks, it got worse as we went on into Greeks. But for the Israelites, they lived in a system of appeasement and a system of blessings received for services rendered, right? But that's kind of part of our world, is it not now? That's pretty much how the entire economy runs on that. And unfortunately, many of our relationships, interpersonal business relationships, you know, even sadly spiritual relationships run on the same principle. Mm-hmm. Blessings received are to be paid for by services rendered, okay? And this corruption had happened in the faith of Israel. I mean, you can't play in the mud hole without getting dirty, right? Or flooding your engine or whatever. Might happen. There's a backstory there. You can't play with the pigs without some of that rubbing off on you. And this religious idea of how you were to interact with God had rubbed off on the children of Israel. And when they got to Mount Sinai and God came down and he displayed to him his character in the Ten Commandment law, and he said, "I'll be your God," what did they say? Yeah, they defaulted, right, to that kind of thinking and said, "All that you have said we'll do and we'll obey and you'll be our God." And they took a relationship stance towards him, the similar, not entirely identical, but very similar to that of Egypt. It was a little more, quote-unquote, sanctified. But it wasn't more sanctified at all, was it? No, it's the same old religion dressed up in a different dress or blouse. I'm not going to let it go, Terry. You shouldn't have said that. That was a mistake. It was. And if you look at the history after Mount Sinai of the children of Israel, it's a very marked contrast between the history before. What happened before when Moses was sent by God, almost prodded there with a big sharp stick, if you remember, by God to tell Pharaoh to let his children go? What happened? That he wouldn't do it. God steps in and he delivers them. Step by step by step. And they're sitting there going, wow. But after Sinai, after they made an agreement or a contract with God, what happens? Not too many weeks later, what do we find them doing? Dancing around a golden calf, the work of their own hands, saying, "These be the gods, O Israel, that brought you up out of Egypt." You know, it had really affected them. This misconception of the relationship that they were to have with God had really, really affected them. I want to take a look now at a word that we hear a lot in the scriptures. It's called, now, before I do that, let me recap. You remember the last time, 2 months ago or whatever it was, that I talked with you? We looked at the idea of an inheritance in the Bible, correct? We looked at and we found that they're everywhere. From page to page, it seems like, there is an inheritance promised to the children of God. Now, that infers something, and I mentioned it the last time, though you probably don't remember it. If an inheritance infers the presence of something else, what would that be? What is the vehicle by which an inheritance is obtained? A will. A will. That is the document needed to have an inheritance. Otherwise, if you go over to great grandma's house and get her silver, that's called theft. Okay? But the will is the legal instrument used to transfer from one individual to another their personal property. Okay? But I want to take a look at covenant. Now, most of the time, when you ask, and I did some heavy polling. Right after this understanding of what diatheke meant came out, I did some heavy polling of the brethren, and it seemed like, and I've had it borne out in a few of the things that I've been studying lately, it seemed like when you say the word covenant, people automatically say it is a contract. Have you heard that? You thought that? Yes, definitely. It's a contract. Okay, so what in our day and age, what is a contract? Dennis, you're a contractor, right? He did my HVAC, did a good job. Well, he didn't do it. His guy did a good job, but he made sure his guy did a good job, right? we had a contract. And what did the contract say, Dennis?
Service for money.
Yeah, Dennis will put in Troy's HVAC, and Troy's going to pay him this really good, it was a good deal, money to do that service for him. Is that what we mean by a contract today?
A contract between equals.
That's right, it's a contract. It is services are delivered and payment is rendered for those services. That's what it is. We have all sorts of examples of it. And so when we see when we say that a covenant is a contract, what do you automatically default to in your thinking?
Payment.
That it's something we're going to get from God for something, correct? Mm-hmm. That's what it is. And this is what I mean by this kind of this PTSD or this misapprehension. But is that really what a covenant is? I want to take a look at it. Is it a contract? Well, the answer in short is yes, and a resounding no. And we'll see what I mean in a minute. I've got some handouts here. I'm going to school on PowerPoint, so hopefully in the near future we might be able to put it up on the screen. It was this big scary monster, but turns out it ain't so tough. So I'll try and get that going on. But in the meantime, you're getting a handout sent to you, and at the top of this handout is a definition from the Strong's Concordance of what diatheke, this Greek word diatheke, means. And I'd like to take a look at it. And this is where we get the idea that it's a contract. All right? Because there's some funky words there that don't immediately draw any kind of information to mind. But there's one in there that says contract, and our minds can just jump to that, right? I mean, this happened when I was doing my pilot training. And it kind of got me in trouble. And while they're handing it out, it's a fun story. What does the rudder on an airplane do? Everybody say push on, it turns you, right? That does not turn you. I thought it did. A rudder doesn't turn you. A rudder only controls what they call adverse yaw. In other words, a body in motion tends to remain in motion unless acted on upon by another force, Newton's law. Well, when you turn an airplane, the airplane wants to keep going that way. The rudder is to prevent it from doing this. Right, the rudder is just to help overcome that. I thought it turned it. I almost killed myself because I thought that. I almost did. I was doing what's called cross controlling, and without giving you an aerodynamics lesson, it can end up with you spinning straight into the ground from low altitude, and it can kill you deader than dead. Misapprehensions. I thought it meant something and it didn't. I thought it did something and it didn't. He did, but he explained it in gobbledygook, right? I am hoping to explain diatheke in very simple words here. That's why you have a definition. And once he explained it by a demonstration at high altitude, I never forgot it, and it took a while for the lump on my head hitting the side of the door to go away. That's how fast it happens. When you get into a cross-controlled spin, it snaps you. Like, there's no time to react. If you're in low altitude, you're dead. And same with diatheke. If you have a wrong understanding of what this word means, it can lead to death, or does lead to death. But there is a word in it. I'm going to read diatheke. It says, properly a disposition. That is specifically a contract. Ooh, there it is. Well, we know what it is, right? Especially a divisory will, covenant, testament. But which one of those words do you use on a daily basis? You only used will when you had to go to the conference to get your will done, right? You don't use that on a daily basis. Which is the only word in there that you really use on a daily basis? It's contract. And that's the mind gravitates towards, and so we say it's a contract. And it is a contract, but it's a different kind of contract than we typically believe it. It's not a contract of goods, services rendered and payment given. It is not that kind of contract. I want to take a look at it. First word, and I didn't put this in my book, and I should have. The first word in that definition is properly. And that's another word that we kind of get wrong. But if you look at that up in the Webster's 1828 dictionary, the word properly means in the strictest of senses. Does that give you admit any kind of wishy-washiness? Well, it could mean this, it could mean that, it might be this thing or that. No, properly means it's dead on, strictly, this is strictly what it is. Without deviation, without exception, this is what it is. There's no ambiguity there. Disposition is the next. So it is strictly a disposition. This word disposition is the act of disposing, distribution, a giving away or giving over to another, as he has made a disposition of his effects. So this is strictly a disposition. And it goes on, this is specifically, there's again an insistence upon no deviation. There's no wishy-washiness at all. A contract. Now you got to be careful here. A contract. It's an agreement or a covenant between two or more parties. Now, this is the Webster's 1828 dictionary definition, okay? Between two or more persons in which each party binds himself to do or forbear some act. Now, he's like, oh, yeah, reciprocity. Woohoo, back and forth here, right? Give and take, give and take, all right? But we have to be careful Because this word contract is defined by the previous word disposition, isn't it? There's different kinds of contracts in our world, are there not? Sure there are. But this is a contract of disposition, to dispose of or give away from oneself what one owns to someone else. It's not a contract of services received, payment rendered. And if we think it is, brothers and sisters, in a spiritual sense, we're in big trouble. And it can poison our entire view of the gospel and of our position and what God requires or what he has promised to give us. And it has and it does. And it's my prayer that it will stop. Divisory. This is a word that is very much not in use anymore. When I read it, I was like, oh, what now? A divisory will. Divisory is relating to, or relating to the division or distribution. So it's a will of distribution is what it's saying there in brackets. Okay? And it says it is a covenant or a testament. Now, what's a testament? You remember in Matthew when Jesus got his disciples together, and we see this at communion when we have it, and when we'll pray God that we have it again soon. This is the blood of the new what? Testament? Which is shed for many for the remission of sins. That word testament there is the same word used in Hebrews 8 and Hebrews 10. This word testament, a solemn, authentic instrument in writing by which a person declares his will as to the disposal of his estate and effects after his death. This is otherwise called a will. So this word diatheke, which is always translated for some reason covenant, is really what, friends? It is a last will and testament by which God has promised an inheritance to his children. And we're going to look at it. When I was going through this, the ramifications were very profound. You remember when we talked last time about the inheritance, I asked the question, is an inheritance something you have to earn? And the resounding answer was no, and it's the right answer. You cannot earn an inheritance. Anybody heard a story where someone thought, oh, there's a rich old lady, I'm going to go ingratiate myself to her and try to get a bit of her money when she dies? Yeah, it happens, sadly. It's a terrible thing, but it happens. What happens, though, if the old lady gets wise to the scheme? Well, she drop kicks the guy to the curb, right? At least hopefully she does. That's what would happen. That's what you and I would do, right? And what do you think God's position is if we sidle up to him to get something? You think he's going to look any kindlier on that? No. We think of those kind of people as terrible, and yet somehow, some way, and I didn't even mean to go here, but this idea that you can get something from God because you did this, that, or the next thing, whether it's a great thing or a tiny little thing, it's a principle matter, by the way, on the magnitude of whatever's being done to receive it. The principle stays the same, does it not? It does. And the reprehensitivity, or whatever you want to call it, I don't know if that's a word, but that, you know, how reprehensible it is or how terrible it is doesn't change just because the intent is the same. And so the problem happens in our spiritual lives when we think that we receive blessing from God because we did something. Because there's a contract. And the Israelites at Mount Sinai thought that. They heard God say, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, house of bondage. And he told them all the thou shalt and thou shalt nots, right? And they got scared. Even Moses said, my knees are knocking, right? And they heard that, they freaked out, and they defaulted. You ever notice how that happens? That's why they train us so hard as pilots. Because they know that if you get into a really bad situation, your training will kick in, and you'll do the right thing. That's why they're over and over and over again until you're like, oh, come on. Funny, have you noticed there, Roger, that that's the same way with preaching sometimes? Sometimes you're like, bang, bang, bang. Nobody listening. But it does happen. It gets through eventually. But this idea that a covenant is an agreement between God and man, whereas we do an exchange, is false based upon the definition of this word. It's false. And it can color your entire relationship with him. And I'm afraid that it has colored the relationship of the church with its Savior for a lot of years. You know, Paul said that we should contend earnestly for the faith once delivered to the saints. Did he not? What does that imply, by the way? If you need to contend earnestly for something we once had, it implies that you don't have it anymore. And there's a lot of things that get corrupted if we view our relationship with God as if it's a contract. It doesn't matter to the devil if that's a lot of corruption or just a little bit of corruption, right? Arsenic in the salad is arsenic in the salad, regardless of how much was put in there. The only benefit can be that arsenic's pretty bitter, I told. I'm not sure who reported that. Seems like you have very scant opportunity to report the taste of arsenic. But, you know, and the more there is, the more you can maybe see it. But the devil's like, oh, you don't like that salad? I'll give you another one. A little bit less. It's all deadly, though. It'll all kill you. Now, when I got to this point in my study of Hebrews, I was faced with a rather disturbing question for myself. And that was the following. Is it safe to base my conclusions solely upon the definition of a word? After all, Mr. Strong's could have been wrong. And I'm no Grecian. I mean, I know a little bit the rudiments of it, but very rudiments. Maybe Mr. Strong was wrong. So is it safe to base your conclusion over on something on a definition of a word? Shouldn't the scriptures you're reading support that definition? They should they not? God doesn't do it in a vacuum, okay? They should support it. And so I was very troubled. I was like, oh, you can't believe this, Troy, unless it's supported by the scriptures you're reading. Well, then I hit verse 9, or chapter 9 of Hebrews, and that's what our scripture reading was, and it says this there. And you tell me, does it support the idea that a covenant is a will and testament? Yeah. Or does it support that it's a contract? I'm going to read it. Now, when someone leaves a what? A will. Ooh, that kind of supports it, doesn't it? It is necessary to prove that the person who made it is dead. The will goes into effect only after a person's death. You know anyone who died to leave a will? Yes, his name is Jesus Christ. Okay? That's what he said to his disciples. This is the blood of the new will that is shed for, thank God it doesn't say few, many, for the remission of sins. That word remission is very interesting. We don't have time today. But it says the will goes into effect only after a person's death. While the person who made it is still alive, the will cannot be put into effect. And then it goes on in Hebrews to say that is why Moses took, when he dedicated the temple, which was the basis or the structure put in place to disseminate the understanding of the first covenant, says that's why Moses, when he dedicated the temple, he took what? Blood and water. And he sprinkled the congregation and the tabernacle and everything with that. And that was to institute and establish the first covenant. Now, I'm not going to go into it too much because next week I want to talk to you about more evidence that this is, in fact, the covenant is, in fact, a will. And that evidence is found in the legal procedures used to implement a will. And our laws in this country are based on Roman law to a large degree. And there is a very specific process. How many of you have made a will, by the way? The rest of you, shame on you. You better get busy. But yeah, there's a very specific process that is required to make a valid will. If you don't follow it, the courts are going to say, that will is not valid. And we should see this process. If Christ made a will, you should see that process evidenced, should you not? You should. I mean, that's not being unfair, is it? No, not being unfair. So this definition does not stand on its own. It's not just me playing with a Greek word and saying, well, I think that's what it means. Am I? Hello? Am I? We just read Hebrews 9, right? It is a will. And the will is an instrument to give an inheritance. Are you at all curious as to what the inheritance is? Yeah, I was. And one of these days when I get there, sorry, Patty, I'm taking so long. When we get there, we're going to find out what it is. We're going to find out what it is. And it is an amazing thing. And you know how we talked about perfection? Absolute moral perfection? That there thing that makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up? That thing which has caused a lot of grief in the church and in people's personal relationship with Jesus? It has something to do with it. And it is the answer to that problem. But next week, I would like to take a look at it. Did Jesus actually establish a will? For it says in Hebrews, behold, the days come, future tense, and he's quoting from the Old Testament, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Jacob. So the days come. What days were they? Are we told? What happened? Did he meet those requirements? If we can show that he did, it should solidify in your minds the fact that a covenant is not a contract of services rendered for money or value received, but that it is rather an inheritance, the promised gift of something. And that something is very wonderful and very necessary to us. So God bless you until we meet next week. And you can keep the hand out. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask me. So God bless you. Oh, before we quit, actually, I want to read one more thing. Guy should follow his notes, shouldn't he? Good grief. Showers of Blessing is our closing song. All right? And it's very interesting, just as a hint of what's contained in that will. We read in Hosea 10 and verse 12. Hosea is one of my favorite books in the Bible. Hosea 10 verse 12, it says, sow to yourself in righteousness, reap in mercy, break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord. Is that true, by the way? You look around our world, if there's ever been a time to seek him, it's today. But it goes on, for it is time to seek the Lord till he come and reign righteousness upon you. I'll say any more than that, but showers of blessing we really, really do need.